Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Greg Howard, author of The Visitors. In The Visitors, a lonely 12-year-old boy spends his day stuck at the deserted Hollow Pines plantation in Georgetown, South Carolina, with no recollection of his name, how long he has been there, and no idea how to leave. When young visitors from the living world arrive for the first time in a long while, the boy feels a spark of hope. But Hollow Pines doesn't like visitors. And with a malevolent spirit lurking in the shadows and painful memories coming to light, the boy wonders if he'll ever find his way home or be stuck in Hollow Pines forever. Greg Howard was born and raised in the South Carolina Lowcountry, where his love of stories blossomed at a young age. Originally set on becoming a songwriter, Greg followed that dream to Nashville, Tennessee, where he spent years producing the music of others before eventually returning to his childhood passion for writing stories. Greg writes for and about LGBTQ youth, creating the kind of books he wishes he'd had access to as a young reader growing up gay in the American South. For more information, you can visit Greg's website, which is www.greghowardbooks.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Greg to the show. Good day, sir.
Hello, Robert. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I love being able to highlight authors who write stories that empower LGBTQ individuals. So I'm really looking forward to talking about your work. So first of all, I mentioned a little bit your road to becoming an author, via music producing in Nashville. But tell us a little bit more about how and kind of when you made that shift to authoring, and in particular, selecting the LGBTQ youth as a target market.
Well, as you said, reading my bio, I was in the music business. That's why I came to Nashville, was to be a songwriter. And I left the day I graduated from college in North Carolina and drove to Nashville to be a songwriter, and ended up working in the music business for over 30 years, producing music, creating product for record companies, running small boutique record labels, that sort of thing. And I had a very nice, good, successful career in the music business. But after 30 plus years, I was kind of burnt out on it, and I was in my late 40s, and at the time that I made this decision, and I thought, you know what, I've always wanted to write a book. And I had been reading a lot of young adult books at that time that highlighted LGBTQ characters, and they were kind of inspiring me. I enjoyed the ones I was reading, but I didn't quite think I could see my particular perspective in those books. And I was like, well, maybe I have a story to write in that age group. So I think I was around 47 or so, and I started writing it, and a young adult book, and started pitching it to agents, went through that whole querying process, which is not for the faint of heart. And I found a brilliant agent at a major literary agency in New York who loved the work. And once we got it in tip-top shape, sent it out on submission, and she sold it to Simon & Schuster. And I got my first publishing contract on my 50th, when I was turned 50. So that's been a good 10 years ago, because I turned 60 next week. So that's kind of how I got there. And then the more I started writing, and then I went into middle grade, writing for a little younger audience, and have been doing that ever since with Penguin, and have just kind of phased out of my music business career and kind of discovered my second act, doing what I always wanted to do when I was a kid.
Wow. Well, early happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
That's a milestone. I reached mine a couple of weeks ago, 70. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So now, when you started started the writing of the book, did you encounter, what kind of resistance did you encounter, about the subject matter of your books?
You know, and I didn't say this before, but one reason, part of my mission was, when I was in middle grade and high school, back many, many eons ago, I couldn't find books that I could see myself in. They just were not available. You know, there weren't these kind of books. And so I was kind of disinterested in reading because I could never find books in which I could see myself. And I know how important that is. Now, when I started writing the young adult middle grade books that I wrote with LGBTQ characters, I knew there was more out there. But like I said, I thought I had my own perspective to share, you know, being from the Deep South, and South Carolina is such a unique area, as you know, especially the Low Country. So I just thought that I'm going to write this from my perspective to see what happens. And honestly, back when the first book came out in 2018, you know, I did not have a lot of resistance. It's interesting to me that the resistance to these books is more prevalent now than it was 10 years ago. So over the years, it got a little worse every year. And then when I was writing middle grade books, you know, because your main character in middle grade books are around 12 years old, and I think there are some people out there who don't want to believe that there are kids out there who are thinking about these things. And I can attest from my own personal experience that they are thinking about these things. I was thinking about them much younger than 12 years old. But you know what really surprised me, Robert, was that I just assumed, you know, we had come a long way as a society, and kids just didn't have as hard a time as I had and people my age had. And we have made, you know, a lot of progress in a lot of ways. But I was amazed that even now when I do book festivals or I go to do school visits, I have kids come up to me, sometimes with tears in their eyes, telling me that this is the first book they've ever read in which they could see someone like them. Now, that just blew my mind, because we know these books are out there now, you know, much more prevalent than when I was young, but the problem is becoming access and discoverability. So, yes, I've had in more recent years some really ugly people rear their head at me. And don't get me wrong, there's been plenty of positive and beautiful letters from parents saying, you know, thank you for these books. I've read it with my child. It really opened up discussions. But, you know, it's always the negative ones that are the loudest. And, yeah, I've had some you know, nasty emails, some threatening. My book, Middle School's a Drag, was discussed on Fox News on the Laura Ingraham show a few years ago about how terrible it was that it was out there. And I have also been discussed on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives about my books, not just me, but me along with other people, as more challenges have, you know, have come about. And it's such a tough time in our country as far as the zeal for book banning. And I try to tell people who ask me or try to convince me that this is this, it's almost like they think that if these books are not on the library shelves in schools, then those kids won't be queer. They won't be gay. You know, they won't be trans. They just won't exist. And that's just not the case, because these books don't tell them who to be. It tells them that they are allowed to exist as they are. It's just showing, it's a mirror, you know, so they can see themselves. And every time you take a book like that off the shelves of school libraries and classroom libraries, you're just erasing those stories. You're erasing those kids. You're telling them that they don't matter, that their stories don't matter, and that there's something wrong with them when there's not.
Yeah. I looked on in the media tab on your website, and I saw that Laura Ingraham kind of calling your book sickening, and I thought, boy, that is the badge of honor I hope he wears.
You know, a lot of people told me that. Here's something, and you didn't say this, but other people say this. They think sometimes when that happens that book sales just go through the roof, and so I got a lot of people saying, well, I bet you're laughing all the way to the bank. And the truth of the matter is, for the majority of us out here, like mid-list authors, that's not what happens. That may happen for a big name author, you know, who already has a presence and is already well known. Yes, that could give them a bump because they have a bigger platform. But most of us, the majority of us, it doesn't help us at all. It hurts us actually. It means there are less opportunities in publishing. It makes it harder to get things published because publishers are scared of books being challenged and being harder to sell. So, yeah, badge of honor in one sense, but then it's just a sad situation in another.
It sure is. Now, in the book, there is a white boy named Will Perkins who is bullied for his same-sex attraction by his father, former best friend, and other classmates. So with this particular bullying activity, is this something that you felt that, you know, because I'm sure many gay students, children, and youth go through that. So was it important, you know, to kind of put that in particular, you know, with the father, friend, and classmates?
Yeah. Well, I'm completely honest about this. I was very lucky. I did not get bullied, but I was also very closeted. Had I been out, it would have been a different situation. So nobody knew, you know, again, I was in middle school and high school in the early 80s, and very closeted and, you know, constantly monitoring how I walked or, you know, how I spoke to other boys or how much I hung out with girls. I constantly worried that somebody was going to suspect. So nobody ever did. I was well-liked in school. I was funny, you know, and I was musical. And so I had a lot of friends, but none of them knew who I was or the struggles I was going through every day of just this imposed shame that society and a lot of times religion puts on you. So I actually, you know, was not bullied. I saw kids bullied who were more comfortable with who they are. And as far as my parents go, my mother died when I was very young, but my dad, I didn't come out to my dad until I was a grown man and he was an older man. And so I did not have it as bad as Will Perkins did by any stretch of the imagination, but I know those kids are out there today. And the thing about it, the reason I think bullying is even more of a problem today is because LGBTQ kids are more comfortable being themselves and living in their identity, which more power to them. I think that's amazing. But therefore, it opens them up to more outright bullying, you know, from family and from friends.
Yeah. And now, my partner, who just passed away last year of 37 years.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thanks. He grew up in Spartanburg. And
okay.
his father was a policeman. So he really had that, paternal disapproval, you know, way heavy. You know, it really impacted his life till the day he died. I mean, it was one of those things. And so, you know, when I, you know, and he would have loved your book, you know, because, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, in particular for boys, you know, the relationship with the father is so important and acceptance is so important, you know, that, you know, hopefully through your book, you'll be able to open eyes of fathers out there so that they, you know, treat their boys properly.
Yes. And I did come from a very religious, conservative background, Pentecostal holiness upbringing. And so, you know, I felt more, honestly, I hate to say this, but I felt more bullied from the church than I did from people at school because of the messages I heard from the pulpit. And then when I did come out in my early 20s, the way the church treated me, and I'm using church as a general term there.
Right.
And for someone who had always been very active in youth group and choir and played the piano in church and just one of those kids that was always involved in everything, same way in college, at a Christian college. But then when they know who, they know this one thing about you, all their perception of you completely changes. And the sad thing is, like, I'm the same person, you know, that you loved yesterday. You just know one more thing about me, but now you don't want to have anything to do with me. So I honestly felt more persecution from the church in my particular case. Now, my dad was a very, you know, country, religious man. And like I said, I didn't come out to him until I was well into my 30s, I think. And to his credit, when I came out to him, he said, I said, well, you probably know this, Dad, but I'm gay. And he just kind of was quiet. I was driving, he was in the passenger seat, and he said, well, no, I didn't know that. And which shocked me, Robert. Like, how could you not have known? I said, well, what do you think about that? And he said, well, all I know is you're my son, and I love you, and you're a child of God. And that's all he had to say. And that was it, you know.
Wow.
So I got very lucky there. And now, did we have long conversations about it after that? No. But, you know, he did meet my partner, and he was very kind. And I really lucked out there. Now, what would the situation have been? I don't know about your partner, but was he out when he was younger?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, see, that's a whole different situation, and I imagine had I come out in middle school or high school, it would have been not as, you know, hunky-dory as it was when we were adults.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, in the book, you have a cafeteria setting where Will is kind of confronted with among friends about being gay, but and then kind of retreats from the table he was at and kind of goes off alone, and then is met with a friend, Sarah, who offers support. So you know, I thought that the whole cafeteria scene and the idea of having a friend, you know, be supportive of someone who is kind of alone, you know, physically and maybe even emotionally, is a very important message to send to school-age kids right now.
It absolutely is. And one thing I love about the Tyler Clementi Foundation and Jane Clementi, who runs that, is her push to celebrate upstanders. You know, the people that, not the bullies and not the people who stand there and watch and don't do anything, but the people that she calls upstanders who step in and either say something, stop something, or offer support. And yeah, I hope whenever we write books like this, especially to the middle grade audience, you hope that one thing you're doing is maybe having a little lesson in empathy. And if kids, let's say, you know, kids who are not gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, they can see this experience and maybe have some empathy for the kids around them. And that is certainly the hope.
And I just thought that that was really encouraging. And then for the youth who read it, to possibly get them motivated, you know, to display that.
Yeah, to display that kind of behavior, yeah. And what... You know, think about high school and middle school. The cafeteria scene was sometimes terrifying. You know, I mean, you were just on display and there were people, some people who were just looking to make trouble. There were some people who were hiding. I remember seeing people sitting alone, and sometimes I would, you know, get up enough courage to go over and sit with them. And other times, quite frankly, I didn't. And I wish I had done that more, because that is a scary time in your life, and it's a scary place to be is when you're just thrown into the cafeteria like that. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And all of the varying groups, you know, the
All the cliques, yes.
All the cliques, yeah, that's the right.
And that that scene where Will is confronting his best friend, and if this is something you're going to ask, I apologize for jumping ahead, but he's confronting his best friend who has now joined the football team, and they're kind of growing a little bit apart because his friend has more friends on the football team. And with this friend, Will was vulnerable enough one time when they were camping to tell him that he just had these feelings for his friend. He actually thought he might, you know, like want to kiss him or had feelings for him. And he didn't know what to do with that. And in the moment, the friend was very supportive. But then, of course, things turned out a lot worse in that situation. And that's something that happened to me in college when I was really struggling in college, you know, dealing with being gay and thinking that I couldn't be a Christian at the same time. And I did the same thing. I came out to my best friend because I thought I had feelings for him. It turns out it was just jumbled, you know, feelings because we were close. And I told him, and he was great, and he was kind and supportive. But then, you know, everything changed, and he started telling people that I was in love with him, and it got ugly. And so I do base some of those moments like that in all my books on things that happened in real life.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, those are such common experiences, you know, that we go through when, you know, trying to find our way, you know, our path.
Yes, yes.
It's good to read about it and recognize that you're not alone in that journey.
Exactly, exactly. Because you do feel like you're, when I was a kid, I thought I was the only little boy in the world who had crushes on other boys. You know, I just did, because I didn't see it, that anywhere, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So you do. It's very isolating.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly can be. Now, in the book, you also have some malevolent spirits kind of lurking around in the shadows. And tell us a little bit about, you know, the idea of having these shadows battle against.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with that. You know, The Visitor is a ghost story.
Right.
It has its lighter moments. It has funny moments, but there are some scares and thrills and some creepiness. And that all stemmed from my love of those kinds of stories when I was a kid and where I grew up and growing up right down the road from a deserted rice plantation like Hollow Pines. And we loved getting scared when we were kids. We thought we had some very legitimate haunted experiences, especially down at that plantation down the road. But so when I was writing this story, I wanted to bring in those fears because I kind of found as an adult, you know, coming into my own and coming out, you know, there's so much fear involved in all that. There's so much fear of not being accepted, of being rejected. So you're right. In the book, I do have these malevolent spirits lurking about, and they could be seen as some of the fears we have within ourselves and fighting against those and fighting our way to the light. So that's very perceptive of you, Robert. And I would say, yes, you picked up on something there.
Yeah. Okay. Now, also one of the messages or themes of your book is regarding forgiveness. So can you tell us a little bit about how that kind of shows up in your book and why you included that as a theme?
Well, it's a big theme in the book, and I included it because there's such healing power in forgiveness, whether it is forgiving a friend, a family member. But I think the biggest gift you can give yourself sometimes is forgiving yourself. And for whatever that may be, something you have done to yourself, something you have thought about yourself, we've all worked against ourselves in one way or another. And this story talks about people not being able to live to their fullest potential until they forgive themselves of things in the past that they're carrying. Because these things we carry end up being almost like those malevolent spirits that are following us around in our fears. And forgiveness has such power. So I wanted to, especially for kids, because as a kid who had a lot of shame and guilt, you know, kind of hoisted on me, like I say, from society and religion, and just on doing it to myself, I had to get to a point where I forgave myself for not being good to myself, as I didn't know any better, you know, and there was a time where I was in a very dark place as a kid, 12, 13 years old, and did not want to be alive because of all this. So I had to get to a point where I forgave myself for things I did and just live in the moment and live in the future. And like the spirit of the boy who was stuck on the plantation, being able to take that step into the unknown.
Yeah. And one of the characters in the book, one of the ghosts is Emma. She was a worker on the plantation, and for her it was the inability to forgive herself for not being able to protect her sister Macy from the boss. So it's one of those things where, you know, I think that just highlights being able to forgive ourselves for something that you know we either weren't able to or just for some reason didn't, you know.
Yeah, sometimes those things are out of our power, out of our control, but yet we still hang on to the guilt.
Yeah, very much. Now, you also in the book touch on the whole South Carolina and slave ownership, plantations and the rice growing. But tell us a little bit about how you kind of approached that the subject of slavery and plantations, and without trying to exercise judgment as to what particular time period was.
Right. Well, as I said, I grew up right down the road from this deserted rice plantation. And we would ride our bikes down there, and we thought we had some haunted experiences down there. And the thing is, we saw that place as just a big playground, you know, just some place that was fun to ride our bikes and explore. And we would go through the old cabins where the enslaved people lived that were run down, and we didn't really understand, you know, what that place was all about. And at that time in South Carolina history in class, we were taught, you know, really the truth of what happened at those plantations. We were given this kind of whitewashed, so to speak, history of how all the enslaved people were like family, and they were treated so well. Look, they built them a chapel. Isn't that nice? And we didn't understand. So obviously, as I became an adult and did my own study and reading and just became more aware of the world, I understood that that was a place that should have been treated with a lot of reverence and, for some people, disdain, but certainly not as a playground, you know. I went back there when I was an adult with some friends. We were going down to Pawleys Island, and I said, I'd like to go, because I was writing about this book, I'd like to go look at it, go see what it is. And this had been turned into a bed and breakfast. which to me was so strange. It was just so odd. But the whole point of including all that is I wanted to, because for most white kids, Robert, they don't have to think about this stuff. They don't have to think about it. It does not cross their mind. It's not something that, you know, that just affects their lives. So I wanted to give them some sort of window into opening up a discussion with young white readers about our history and about looking at it from through a realistic lens. Now, I wanted to be very careful about that because I am a white guy. Fortunately, I have people of color in my life and in the publishing industry guiding me. And so I was able to really get their take on what I was doing. There were some people that didn't think I should set this on a deserted rice plantation at all. Honestly, they were white people. So it's such a strange thing. But in the end, my editor, who is a woman of color who is on, her has origins in South Carolina, she helped me to make sure that the characters of the enslaved ghosts, the ghosts of the enslaved people who are still stuck on the plantation, were well drawn and not just wallpaper, you know. Because as writers, sometimes we get so focused on writing our main characters that all of our secondary characters become kind of one-dimensional. And it's something we always hear, you got to flesh these characters out. You got to give them their own stories. But for those characters like Emma and Rita May and Preacher and Cousin Cornelius, I really wanted to make sure that they were fully formed individuals and not just set pieces.
Yeah, and you did a wonderful job of kind of creating their individuality or being able to express their individuality. And, you know, in particular with Emma and her missing finger.
Right.
You know, that it was taken off by the overseer because she once pointed it at him.
Right.
You know, and that... For me, it was like, whoa, you know, I mean, it kind of adds that, you know, sense of reality that, you know, everything wasn't, you know, as fine and dandy as some try to portray it.
Right, exactly. And I think it's important, like I say, that we look at it through a clear lens. And whereas some of these books, one of the reasons I write books for queer kids is because I want these books to be a mirror for them where they can see themselves. But then there's also the whole mission of making these books a window. So kids who don't have those experiences or who are white, who are not LGBTQ, have a window into someone else's life.
Yeah. And in generating that empathy that you talked about,
that is
really so important. Yeah. So now, what do you hope, you know, the reader, the youth, LGBTQ youth, take away from reading The Visitors?
Well, I want them to take away the feeling that, A, first of all, they're not alone, because the boy at the beginning of this story, the spirit of the 12-year-old boy, is completely alone. He has these friends, you know, that are also stuck there, but really he has such a sense of isolation and loneliness. And I want these kids to know that they're not alone, you know, and that we see them. And I want them to know that their stories, like that boy's story, like Will's story, like Rita May's story and Emma's story, all that their stories have value, their stories matter, and that we need to be good to ourselves and stop tormenting ourselves, which we're so good at doing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I want these kids to feel seen, to know they're not alone, and to know that their stories have value.
Yeah, that's great. Is there, you know, for those listening, is there anything that they can do to help you promote your books or get out the message?
Well, sure. Well, you know, certainly authors like me, we always, the biggest way we sell our books is word of mouth. You know, that mm-hmm. that's just the case. We don't have the big marketing campaigns behind us that some of the bigger authors do. So I would say, since you're asking, a way that people can help from my books and books like mine is, first of all, take a chance, you know, read it, see what you think. If you like it, just tell people about it, post about it. They probably don't realize how important their reviews are on sites like Goodreads and places like that. Even short little love this book, you know, those kind of reviews really, really help authors like me, and just spreading the word. I love it when people tell me that because I have a lot of adults who read my book. They're not just read by kids. I feel like I've crafted books that kids are interested in reading, but then adults find deeper meanings in, and they love the writing and the stories also. And I love it when I have an adult say, I love The Visitors, and I bought 2 copies, and I gave it to 2 kids in my neighborhood, you know. So stuff like that really helps authors like me.
Great. Well, Greg, I really enjoyed chatting with you, and I really want to thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you, Robert. It was great talking to you, too. Thanks for the time.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Greg Howard, author of The Visitors. And again, you can find out more information about this and his other books by visiting the website www.greghowardbooks.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.